think historically about how media inform American culture. Film has, in the 20th century, film has a very important role in that it is the technological and aesthetic foundation that helps explain how our contemporary culture has become a visual culture. Visual culture can include photographs as well as films. It can include television and video, and now it can include electronic imaging.
Film historian and media critic David Rodowick. He'll be back in just a moment with more about the movies and mass media in American society. Welcome to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Modern Language Association of America, which encourages the teaching and study of language and literature. For decades, movie making has been a potent force in American popular culture, and broadcasting has been equally influential. But it's only relatively recently that the movies, as well as radio and TV, have become subjects for academic exploration and systematic analysis of how they help to shape the society we inhabit. Listen now for an overview of those topics. David Rodowick teaches at the University of Rochester, where he directs the Film Studies program. He's the author of several books about the history and philosophy of film and its cultural circumstances. For openers, I asked David Rodowick to reflect on how best to categorize the movies. Are they a genuine form of art, or should we think of them as just an expression of popular culture?
I think it's, paradoxically, I think it's easier to talk about film and all media as social machinery, as it were, rather than art. Because when you talk about art, so many different kinds of subjective opinions come into play. On the other hand, where, let's say, the mass arts are concerned, and that would include film and television, undeniably you have a medium that is affecting how people think, what they believe, how they perceive themselves as individuals, as belonging to a certain nationality, as having gender. All of these questions about how people identify themselves, what they think, what they believe, are being mediated in some way.
Let me put it to you this way, David Rodowick. We're in a way, we're back to that wonderful old chestnut about the chicken and the egg. Does the film industry help to shape American culture? Or, in effect, is it simply a reflection of what is out there? You have this wonderful battle that goes on, you know, well, we just give people what they want. And then on the other side, no, wait a minute, you're actually inventing this culture as you move through it. How about that?
Yeah, another interesting question that is. I can give two responses, one of which is that the film industry is shaping American culture, but they don't know it usually. I mean, they think they know it because they do a lot of marketing and they're trying to figure out what kinds of films to make and what kinds of television programs to make. But I think in terms of the real effects of moving images on people and the nation at large, they don't know what they're doing. I can give an interesting example of that, especially in terms of responding to the question, the chicken and egg question. You know, are they giving the people what they want? Right now, we're in a very interesting boom in terms of African-American filmmaking and Hollywood's interest in African-American directors, African-American issues and themes. Now, this is very welcome because it's been rare in the history of American cinema and in television. There is a media critic named Edward Guerrero, who's an African-American, just published a very interesting book called Reframing Blackness. And Ed makes the point that in the history of cinema, the film industry, Hollywood, has been interested in African-American issues and directors only in recessionary times. That is, when they need to expand their audience and therefore...
And look like good guys, huh?
And look like good guys at the same time.
Right.
Although in the early 70s, in the early 70s, what the response was called the blaxploitation genre,
right.
You know.
The Shaft movies.
Right. Uh-huh. Rather than Spike Lee or John Singleton, Charles Burnett films that are aesthetically complex and interesting and take on social issues. And this is is a bit of a cynical reading of Hollywood, but it's true. Does Hollywood give the people what they want? Well, not all of the people. And when they perceive that there's a market they can address, well, they will try to address it.
Well, now, in a way, what you're leading us to, Dave Rodowick, is the question of the political importance, the political significance of media in our culture. You've been talking about films and African-American filmmakers. Let me just put it to you directly. The accusation is that people who do the kind of thing that you do, you run a created a film studies program at Yale, and you are certainly part of one now at the University of Rochester, that this is not film studies, really. This is a political agenda. This is a form of ideological activism. Now, we've opened a very large issue, and I want you to give me a sense of the players and the, you know, what's at stake here. How about that?
Yeah. I think one can answer that by looking at two different versions of ideology. One is the pejorative one, which is do the media indoctrinate people in political beliefs, or do certain left-wing academics indoctrinate people with political beliefs?
Right.
And certainly from certain quarters, that's a charge against certain fields like media studies, which is quite frankly less concerned with questions in art and more concerned with questions of how media affects society and how people think. I would certainly hate to think that I'm indoctrinating my students in any way.
You don't walk into the classroom with any particular item on the in front of you, a crude list of political concerns.
No, of course not.
Right.
Of course not. But this brings me to a second definition of ideology, which is certainly not a pejorative one, and which asks us to look at how we know what we know through movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that my basic task as an educator and the basic issue for media studies overall is to introduce students in ways of thinking about the media self-consciously in terms of their relationship to the media, how they understand themselves and their culture through the media, to give the students the critical tools for them to make those decisions. If they're political decisions, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a wonderful phrase from a French film theorist named Christian Metz, who was one of the founders of film semiotics, one of the really great teachers of film theory who unfortunately died a few years ago. But Metz had the best definition of film theory that I ever heard, and he said that the goal of film theory was to understand how films are understood. And to the degree to which that is a social question, that's how I would define ideology as a question on the table for film theory.
What you're suggesting is that film is not some special category off by itself in the world of politics or ideology. We could be speaking of virtually anything in our culture, the way the banks work, the way McDonald's is operated, the way theme parks run, that we're like the fish in the sea. We're really not fully aware of the environment that we inhabit.
Yeah, in that respect, one could say that in those various disciplines, whether it's economics, history, business, one can approach ideology in the same way in terms of giving people critical concepts for understanding. Now, one can talk about what the specific interest of film and media studies is in that, well, until television, well, if we think historically about how media inform American culture, film has, in the 20th century, film has a very important role, and that it is the technological and aesthetic foundation that helps explain how our contemporary culture has become a visual culture.
Mm-hmm.
Visual culture can include photographs as well as films. It can include television and video, and now it can include electronic imaging.
Let me stop you for a moment, Dave Rodowick. The charge comes to mind that we are living in a culture, as you say, that is decidedly visual, that we are getting away from the traditional forms of knowing, the book, for example, that television and radio and mass media spell the death of reading and books. Again, a very large issue that I want you to give me a quick answer to. Is that possible?
And I think I can answer that by sort of backtracking on what I was talking about, which is to say that Stories are told through books,
right,
as they are told through newspapers, and stories are told through films. We listen to those stories and we read those stories. Film, I think, historically has become the foundational medium for how stories are told visually through time, and it presumes certain skills of reading. Now, will the book disappear? No, of course not. It's not even going to disappear with CD-ROMs. And I mean, there's a lot of talk about what electronic publishing means and and access to books through our computer screens. And they are two very different technologies, the book and the movie, or the book and the video. And I think they presume actually two very different skills of reading.
But they're not exclusive. They're not. There isn't a necessary hostility or tension between these two.
No, not at all. And in fact, I think it's very striking to think, you know, rather than making a contrast between books and films, it's interesting, first, in terms of visuality, it's interesting to strike a contrast between reading and listening.
Uh-huh.
Because actually, reading a book is a very visual act in a way that listening to a story is not. Such that while people usually strike a contrast between print medium and, say, photographs, in some respects, in terms of the activity of reading and understanding, they are both visual media.
Mm-hmm.
They're taken in through the eyes, as it were, such that I think actually reading a book shares more with watching a movie than it does with hearing a story.
David Rodowick, we're talking about film studies, the importance of media in our American culture and our mass culture. You are a professor at the University of Rochester. Let me present you with yet another large order. The charge is that we live not only in an age of media and visual effects and power of media, we live in an age that is succumbing to the term, I think, is infotainment, that the values of media, regardless of how much we praise them on their own terms, storytelling, aesthetics, things like that, that they have moved into the serious business of culture, and they are diluting, even corrupting, our ability to understand the world that we live in. Would you respond to this, please?
Yeah. Not only infotainment, but information saturation,
right,
is an interesting issue. And it's, this is a vexed issue. I think it's transforming how we read and how we understand information. And I hesitate to make value judgments about it. I mean, I hesitate to make value judgments about it until we understand better what is indeed happening, how we get information, how much information we get, and how rapidly we get it is changing very fast. And it's a subject of some anxiety for individuals and for the culture at large.
What do you say, for example, when you questions like this come up in your classes at the University of Rochester? Do you essentially try to console the students or warn the students? Or what is your posture?
Well, I'm not their therapist. I'm their teacher. So I discourage them from crying on my shoulder about it.
Right.
In point of fact, the students are much less worried about it than the teachers or their parents are, because they're much more acclimated to it. On the other hand, because they're much more acclimated to it, it's much more natural to them, and there's a certain danger to that. Such that what I think the goal of film studies is, and media studies is once again to give them the capacity to understand the conveyance of information
critically. The awareness of awareness, so to speak.
Yes.
That's what we're after.
You know, everyone knows that films tell stories, but very few students think about how the story is told visually, what the language of film is, how the translation of a story into a visual medium changes it and makes it different from a literary medium.
And concurrent with this, you are teaching in some fashion what, critical faculties? That is to say, the ability not only to be aware of one's awareness, but to make some judgments along the way about what's important, what counts, and what doesn't count.
Yeah. One of the difficulties of visual media, film and television, is that they are temporal. And except for the instances in which you're watching a videotape and you can stop it and fast forward or reverse,
mm-hmm,
usually when you're watching a movie, You know, it's going forward and it doesn't stop for you.
It's like experience itself.
Exactly. And a lot of the a lot of what one takes on board in terms of watching a film is unconscious or subconscious. It's happening just below that critical level where you don't have a second thought about what's the politics of this movie, or does it have a politics?
Same thing can be said about reading novels or poems.
Except for the fact that you control the time. You control the time of the reading.
That's right. You can stop and go back and reread the page.
Yeah, uh-huh. And video has certainly utterly transformed the field in that respect during the time I've been teaching. But in terms of people's daily experience of films in the theater or watching television on their television sets, that is not true. They don't control the time of the reading.
Let me give you a specific issue to consider, Dave Rodowick, and that would be war, just the single word war, or the military. I remember reading a piece by a critic, Michael Arlen, I think his name was, in The New Yorker. He talked about how during the Vietnam War, Americans would never accept a television sitcom about Vietnam. It was too close. It was too raw. Mm. And yet, as time went by, that's basically what we have experienced. He mentioned movies about World War II. The German military is just the essence of evil, and then we end up with things like Hogan's Heroes. Are we on the right track when we look back at examples like that and try to understand our understanding of the way media work in our society?
Yeah. No, that's a really interesting juxtaposition, because in those examples where war is concerned, we see how the media are involved in rewriting history, as it were. And I don't mean that in an entirely negative sense. I don't mean it in the sense that they're falsifying history.
Yeah, it's nothing sinister. It's many factors at work.
It's that the culture has an investment in thinking about what its recent past is.
Uh-huh.
And I like the example you bring up, because I think it's true that during the time of the Vietnam War, American society wouldn't accept a sitcom about the Vietnam War. Although I was in high school at the time, it was my sister's first husband died in Vietnam. And, of course, that experience, many people had that experience. I wasn't alone in that. But it shows why, when the experience is very personal, that having it fictionalized, either in movies or television, it would seem in very bad taste.
Mm-hmm.
But once time has passed, and, for example, once the war is over, people want to, especially when the experience is violent, both for individuals and for the society at large, people want to rewrite it, to try to understand it in new ways. And especially where Vietnam is concerned, I think you can see in television and films very different kinds of remappings of what the war meant for American society. Some I agree with, some I don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
But you see the way in which the media become very important for society in terms of negotiating how we understand our history.
It's like sitting on the family couch and looking at the family album, and you hear different readings of different pictures. Uncle this and aunt that,
yeah.
That sort of thing. It occurs to me, you know, the winner of the Best Picture Award for 94-95, Forrest Gump, in a way, that's a coming to terms with Vietnam. It's a retelling of that episode in our history.
Yeah. I think it's significant that the Vietnam War plays an important role in that film. The Vietnam War is basically one chapter of dozens of chapters in this individual's life, in the way that the chapters of that individual's life gives us a sweep of recent American history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that although it's certainly a very powerful, emotionally powerful part of the film, there's a way in which the importance of the war is downgraded, as it were, by simply becoming a single chapter in this person's life. The other thing is that part of the emotional power of the film comes from the fact that it's filtered through and individual. It's Forrest Gump, his life, who dominates the film, his point of view that we read the film through. And in that respect, it reduces a social history to an individual history. And that's a way of making the war safe, making us feel good about the war and about war veterans again. But I don't think it's a particularly productive way to work through the trauma of the war. that I think that the film consoles us about the war and about Vietnam veterans, but not in a way that's productive in terms of a critical understanding of the war.
Dave Rodowick, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Let me bring you back to a point that you touched on earlier, and that is the importance of understanding media. That is a title that has a familiar ring to it.
Right.
When we speak of American education, speak to me about this for a few moments, would you please?
Yes. I really think that media studies should be the core of any humanities curriculum in the United States today.
Now, that's a very large claim that you're making.
Yes,
there.
Indeed it is.
In contrast to some people who look back to rather more traditional notions of the humanities.
Right, exactly. And in fact, if one looks at society today, there's huge debates going on in politics about the media, about the fate of public broadcasting, about funding for the arts, and so forth. And it's important that this debate be an informed debate. And the debate itself is informed by certain perceptions of how the media inform American society.
And what's your take on this?
My take on this is that that students, just as students need to know how to express themselves well in speech and in writing, just as students need to know how to read well, hence the importance of literature classes, students also need to know how to understand the media and understand how they understand the media and be able to express that critically. And this means not only understanding how the media work in terms of how images and sounds are organized, but understanding what the history of the media has been in relation to the other arts, and also understanding what the economic history of media are, which is a very important subject matter. And all these issues have to be addressed in the classroom, not only in terms of how students think, but in terms of how they will express themselves in writing and just speaking to others and their opinions about the media, but also in terms of how they will become media makers themselves. Almost everybody has a video camera at home now, and a lot of students are coming through media studies programs to become media professionals.
Well, you really are hovering around the word interactive here. Media as not a one-way series of avenues, but very much a dynamic kind of process.
Yeah, it's evolving in that way in very important ways. Of course, television and film are one-way or unilateral medium. You can't talk back to them.
Oh, you can, but they don't hear
you. Yeah,
but
they don't hear you is the problem, and usually don't respond to you either. But in terms of the way visual media are developing, if first we had the cinematic age and then a televisual age, and now we're moving into the multimedia age, and with a certain amount of excitement about the World Wide Web and when the internet, which is a two-way medium, becomes a graphical or a multimedium, as it were, when the web is not only enabling two-way communication, but sort of nonlinear navigation of information that includes sounds, images, text, and so forth. It becomes more and more crucial to understand how that audiovisual medium is working.
Should we be excited about things like the internet and the World Wide Web because of what it is, or should we be excited about these things because of the opportunities they offer for human beings to react to one another? I remember, was it Henry Thoreau who said, well, we've got a telegraph between Texas and New York, but what if the people in Texas and New York don't want to talk to one another?
Well, you don't have to if you don't want to. I mean, I think the really important question now is to what extent is that resource going to be a public resource or a private resource? And here we have the other very important national debate of the internet versus the so-called information superhighway. The information superhighway being a commercial network that is being built and is going to be very expensive to build, and the internet being what is basically a very anarchic government resource that's a public space. The beauty of the internet being that it is a public space, and as nutty as it is and as hard as it is to use, and it's very hard to use, it's not easy, it nonetheless is free of charge and offers fantastic abilities fantastic resources for exchanging information.
I've heard it said that the difference metaphorically between the internet, models of the internet, would be the Greek and the Roman model. Hmm. Rough and tumble in contrast to a rather more, organized and, controlled kind of mechanism.
Yeah, but it's important to remember that the information superhighway will be organized and controlled with respect to a specific objective, which is making a profit. That is, the information superhighway is being constructed by commercial companies, mm-hmm. and to the extent that they're putting up the money to invest in it, they have a right to make a profit. There's no doubt about it. But because they need to make a profit, and I certainly don't object to that at all, they are going to set the parameters for, they're going to set how expensive it is to have access to information, what kinds of information you have access to. Now, I think that's very valuable. For example, I have an internet email address, and I have an email address on America Online. And I really think that there's room for the internet and the information superhighway to coexist. But what I fear in the debate is the ways in which people want the information superhighway to replace the internet. It certainly will be technologically more advanced. It will allow us to access visual images as well as text. But I think that the federal government needs to understand that the internet needs to be maintained, built, and expanded as a public resource.
David Rodowick teaches at the University of Rochester, where he directs the Film Studies program. His books include The Difficulty of Difference and The Crisis of Political Modernism. His new book is a study of the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze, forthcoming from Duke University Press. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Modern Language Association of America, which encourages the teaching and study of languages and literature. Audio cassettes of this discussion are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 776. That's $10, program number 776. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code 27709. Next week on Soundings, poet Michael McPhee. He's the editor of a new anthology of the work of 15 North Carolina poets. Michael McPhee will be here with readings and a conversation about that book, a collection entitled The Language They Speak is Things to Eat. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Movies and mass media in American culture, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with film historian David Rodowick of the University of Rochester. He says that the movies have been around for a long time now, but it's only relatively recently that we've begun a systematic analysis of how they work in our society. The movies and mass media in American culture. Some answers and insights from film historian David Rodowick this week on Soundings.